Well, good evening, and thank you for joining me. My name is Dr. David Rubin. I am the chief of the section of gastroenterology at the University of Chicago, and I specialize in taking care of patients who have inflammatory bowel disease. I'm really delighted that you've chosen to learn a bit more about ulcerative colitis tonight, and I'm pleased that CME Outfitters has put together this wonderful program for you. The title of our program is called New Guidelines in Ulcerative Colitis, Why Should I Care? And it reflects the updates we've made in treating patients with ulcerative colitis. There, in fact, have been a number of significant improvements in the way we diagnose and treat people who have this condition. And I'm delighted to share them with you tonight, as well as some of the newer guidelines that have been published and recommended to my colleagues who take care of patients like you. Ulcerative colitis is a chronic condition. That means that it lasts for almost a lifetime or for your entire lifetime. It is most often diagnosed in people between ages 15 and 30, but very importantly, some people are older when they're diagnosed with ulcerative colitis. The cause of ulcerative colitis is not known, but it is characterized predominantly by inflammation of the large intestine. Your large intestine consists of the rectum, which is the last 6 or 8 inches of it, and the colon, which is the remaining part of the large intestine. Your anal canal and your appendix are also part of the large intestine, but they are not involved in the condition known as ulcerative colitis. The inflammation in ulcerative colitis continues from the rectum up into the colon and is in a continuous fashion that may involve just the rectum, where we call it proctitis, or parts of the colon, where we call it proctosigmoiditis, where it involves the sigmoid colon, or the left part of the abdominal cavity in the left colon, where we call it left-sided colitis, or the entire colon may be involved, where we call it extensive or pancolitis. The extent of colitis and what causes it is not really understood, but we recognize that different people have different extents of this condition. The main symptoms of ulcerative colitis are urgency to go to the bathroom and bloody bowel movements. Because this condition is chronic and can go on for quite a while, some patients live with these symptoms before they're diagnosed and are quite nervous about what it might be. The condition is also characterized by what we call relapsing and remitting features. That means that it is active at times and gives people lots of symptoms, and at other times it's in remission or quiet and patients may feel completely back to their usual self. Of course, our treatment goals are to get people feeling back to their usual self and have that last as long as possible. There are many different treatments available for ulcerative colitis, and even though we don't know the cause, we've gotten much better at monitoring the condition as well as treating it to control it. Now, I have some representative images of what ulcerative colitis can look like for you here. All the way on the left is what a normal colon looks like when we use a scope like a colonoscope to look inside the bowel. You can see the normal blood vessels and the shiny appearance of a healthy bowel. The different degrees of inflammation appear as you look towards the right, from mild to moderate to severe. And the amount of inflammation, not surprisingly, will dictate how many symptoms our patients have or how sick they might become. Different patients have different degrees of inflammation. So just to summarize, we don't know the cause of this condition. Many patients have different extents of inflammation of their large intestine, and there's also different degrees of inflammation that may occur. Patients who have inflammatory bowel disease are not necessarily aware that there are actual guidelines for managing their condition. And in fact, CME Outfitters convened a panel of patients and recorded some representative quotes from them. So let's hear what patients had to say about whether they knew whether there were guidelines for managing inflammatory bowel disease.
A lot of IBD patients are very confused, and there's a lot of misinformation on the internet.
I don't think that patients are aware of clinical guidelines very much at all.
So let me teach you what guidelines are and what they're not, and also bring you up to speed. In general, guidelines have been published for professional healthcare providers like physicians and advanced practice providers and for our nursing colleagues. But it's very important to understand that, of course, patients should be aware of what these guidelines say. My hope with tonight's program is to educate you about the guidelines so that you can have an informed discussion with your healthcare team about your treatment options. So let's review a couple details about what practice guidelines are and how they are created. Guidelines are written by experts in the field. I'm going to share with you two recently published guidelines related to ulcerative colitis. They contain recommendations for clinicians about patient care. Their recommendations are based on evidence as performed in clinical research studies. Sometimes recommendations are based on the best opinions of the experts when evidence isn't available. Guidelines are published by our societies in most cases, and in the case of the two guidelines I'm sharing, they were published by the two largest GI societies in the United States, the American College of Gastroenterology and the American Gastroenterological Association. These two societies have members who are professional medical and healthcare providers. These societies also publish these guidelines to advance the field, but there have not been in the United States patient-related summaries of these guidelines, which is why this program is so important. There are some limitations to guidelines. First, they may become out of date very quickly. As soon as we publish them, there may be an advance in the field or new therapies. And of course, we all want that for the field. We're looking for cures of colitis and the other inflammatory bowel conditions. But in the meantime, as new treatments become available and new scientific evidence emerges, the guidelines may become out of date. So it's always important to know when they were published and what might have changed since they were published. And I'll even be mentioning that briefly tonight. Secondly, guidelines are just meant to give us guidance. They don't necessarily apply to all patients. And one of the messages about ulcerative colitis and Crohn's is that every patient is different. And recognizing what your condition may involve and how you may be treated is up to you and your healthcare team to discuss and understand. The guidelines may give you some ideas and help provide evidence to back up certain treatment decisions, but they are by no means meant to fit every single situation. And lastly, as much as we'd like the guidelines to influence how insurance companies and other payers provide support and approve the payment of different treatment strategies, sometimes the guidelines aren't known by our payers or are just ignored by the payers because the evidence isn't strong enough or perhaps the recommendation is too expensive. That's a whole other topic that we can talk about on another broadcast. When we look at guidelines, they use evidence that has been published, and there are different levels of evidence. The lowest level of evidence are the opinions of experts when there's no research to back up those opinions. The opinions may be formed by experts who are very experienced, but without any clinical scientific studies to back up those opinions, that's why this is considered the lowest level of evidence. They may be included in guidelines, but are noted as such. Secondly, would be cases that are reported, individual cases or case series of multiple patients who have similar disease characteristics or responses to new therapies or different uses of existing therapies may be included, and that's the next level of evidence. A higher level of evidence than the one that the Food and Drug Administration asks for before drugs get approved for their availability and use is a randomized clinical trial. And a randomized trial in which both the investigator and the patient are blinded as to whether they're receiving one treatment or another is the highest level of scientific evidence. So having randomized trials that are blinded that demonstrate the benefit of one treatment over another is a higher level of evidence. And when there have been multiple randomized trials that all demonstrate the same result, that's the highest level of evidence that factors into a guideline. So as I summarize the two major guidelines during this program, I want you to keep in mind that there are different levels of evidence for the different types of recommendation. It's impossible for me to go through all the recommendations of these two guidelines tonight, but I do want you to understand the main principles and some of the general thoughts that are going that went into these guidelines and that you should know when you're talking to your healthcare team. There are many similarities between the American College of Gastro guideline on the left, which I was part of, and the AGA, or the American Gastroenterological Association guideline on the right. There are many thoughtful experts who contributed. There was peer review by other experts, and overall the committees in both of these societies also review these guidelines before they are published. So there's a multi-step process that leads to these guidelines. Now, what's new in the 2019 ulcerative colitis guidelines? Well, there have been a significant number of advances in our field that are worth mentioning, and what I will be driving home this evening. The first one is a shift from reactive management of flares to a proactive monitoring and prevention approach to preventing flares and preventing bad outcomes from colitis. In the past, management of ulcerative colitis was very much focused on symptom management and treating patients based on how they presented to us, rather than trying to get ahead of the disease to know when a flare may be starting before a patient even feels them, and certainly before the patient has a consequence or a bad outcome. The second major shift in the way we think about things is the separation of inflammatory activity from prognosis, or what we call severity. Activity is how sick a patient feels at the time they're being evaluated, how much inflammation there is. Severity has to do with what might happen over time, like what is the likelihood the patient will need steroids or will be hospitalized or might have surgery from their colitis. Another major advance in the field is now the understanding, appreciation, and the ability to heal the bowel, and that has become now a target of our management. So in addition to wanting to make sure people feel better, we're also focused on healing the bowel, which we know is associated with better outcomes. And I'll talk more about this in a few minutes. There have been multiple new therapies approved since the last set of guidelines were published by the societies, and we'll be talking more about these new therapies tonight, and I'll go through those in more detail coming up. We also have advanced the field in that we don't always need to do colonoscopies anymore. I know everyone's happy to hear that. In order to assess how much inflammation is in the bowel, we are now appreciating and using stool tests as markers of inflammation in specific situations. And we'll talk more about that as well in this program. And lastly, there's a new treatment for infections of the colon. The infection that we know is of significance and very important to look for and treat in ulcerative colitis and in Crohn's disease is called Clostridioides difficile. It used to be called Clostridium difficile, or C. diff for short. And we now treat this with vancomycin instead of some of the older treatments that had been used previously. The goals of management for ulcerative colitis are very important to understand. If you have ulcerative colitis, I want you to think carefully about where you might be in these goals and whether you're achieving them. The first goal is to make sure we're clarifying the disease activity and understanding the prognosis or severity. That includes knowing how much of the bowel is involved and what the overall risk for needing surgery might be. That helps us choose our therapies, as we'll be spending more time talking about tonight. The second goal is to induce remission, and the term induction of remission means turning off the disease or making the patient feel better. We want this to happen as quickly as possible for obvious reasons. We also distinguish between clinical remission, which I will define for you in a moment, and healing of the bowel, which together, clinical remission, feeling better, and healing of the bowel is what we call complete remission. The next goal is prevention of relapse. So once we successfully induce remission, we want the disease to stay away forever. That's our goal, at least. And we sometimes call this goal maintenance. But the goal of maintenance is to prevent relapse. It's not to be taking active therapy because you still have active disease. It's about preventing relapse. And one of the major features of prevention of relapse in the maintenance phase is to do so without the use of steroids, which we know have some of the worst outcomes in colitis. And the last goal, which comes after we've successfully achieved the other ones, is the prevention of disease and drug-related complications, like infections or hospitalization or surgery or the development of cancer of the bowel. And we'll talk more about these tonight. So when we talk about remission, of course, from a medical point of view, we might talk about the bowel being healed or the number of bowel movements, but actually we recognize that for patients, remission has a very different definition. It really has more to do with how you're functioning and things you want to do in life. So let's see what one of our representative patients said during our panel discussion.
Remission looks like being able to live my life fully without suffering from IBD, without putting things aside. I have activities that I can't participate in just from the symptoms and the pain from IBD. I have had to sit out from things, had to leave work early because of my symptoms. So remission to me is not having to do things like that where my life is impacted in a negative way.
So you obviously hear from this patient how much remission means functioning, doing all the things that are important in life. And I completely understand that. And that's what we're trying to achieve for our patients. And for some patients, getting back to their normal life activities, taking care of family, going to school, getting to work, are different. And we have to think carefully about what would be most important for them as we try to choose our treatment options. Now, there are different levels of ulcerative colitis activity. The first column in this table, that is from the ACG guidelines, summarizes some of the different features of disease activity: number of stools, whether there's blood in the stools, whether the patient has urgency, meaning they have to run to the bathroom, the blood count, markers of inflammation, and also how the bowel looks if we use a scope. You can see in the second column how we define remission, which means the patient is both having form stools without any blood or urgency, but also all the inflammatory markers, labs, and the endoscopic appearance of the bowel is normal. Then we go into mild, moderate to severe, and fulminant colitis, where, as you would expect, the number of bowel movements goes up, the number of times that a patient sees blood in their stool increases, the amount of urgency they experience is increased, and the blood count may drop, the inflammatory markers are elevated, and the way the bowel looks, like those pictures I showed you already, starts to demonstrate more and more inflammation and more severe ulcers. So when a physician or your healthcare provider is looking at how to choose your treatments, the very first thing they need to do is define how active the disease may be. And you'll notice that the first few rows here are focused on your symptoms, and the bottom rows are all focused on other objective measures of what's going on with your disease. And that's a very important composite. Now, this table summarizes how you should think about prognosis. This is based on a number of different studies and is included in our guidelines as well as what are called care pathways related to colitis. And this is based on what factors increase the risk that somebody with colitis might end up needing surgery, which we recognize nobody wants to have unless they need it. The factors associated with an increased risk for surgery include being diagnosed at a younger age. For specific reasons that we don't always understand, people who are diagnosed with colitis at a younger age tend to have a more aggressive colitis. Having extensive colitis, meaning more of that large intestine is inflamed, puts you at a higher risk. Having more severe inflammation when you look with the scope, like those pictures I showed you. Being in the hospital or needing hospitalization for the colitis increases the risk. So does having elevated inflammatory markers or having a low albumin, which is a protein in the blood that's usually a marker of your nutrition and health, but can be low when people are sick and also when the colon is actually leaking protein, which is what happens when it's very inflamed. So we can put all these together with a variety of other ones that we've also learned about and understand what the prognosis might be. So of course we want our patient to have mild or no activity of their colitis, but we also have to keep in mind what is their overall risk for surgery later, so we can define how to follow them, how to monitor them more carefully, how to choose the right maintenance therapies, and what to do as soon as the earliest sign of a relapse occurs.